We're doing the Rambam, the 13 principles, which the Rambam includes in his introduction to the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin. And we're holding by the fourth principle, Vayisod HaRevi'i, the fourth principle, the fourth foundation, HaKadmut. Kadmut means like Kadam, preceded, the eternal precedence. That God precedes this world eternally, precedes everything. Vehu, this concept is as follows. Shezeha echad hamtoar, that this singular one which we have described, hu hakadmon bechlet. He is completely and eternally precedential. Vechol nimtza zulato, and anything that exists other than God, who bilti kadmon beyachas elav, is not precedential, does not have precedence when we compare it to God. And you could say, this mountain is ancient, this world is ancient, but whatever you're going to describe doesn't come close to God, because God always was. Now, this is a concept which we're going to expand on in a minute, but we have to know that the Gemara says that people could get into trouble when they start thinking about what was before the world was created. You start working that backwards, you'll see that you don't really have an answer. And if you remember, in our introduction to the class, we said that on the one end, what we see in this world is that man comes from man. We don't see man being created by anything other than other men. But as far back as you go, at some point you'll hit a question mark. Where did it all begin? And we said that the beginning, the first logical definition of God, is that question mark. Something that is beyond what we see in this world. Something that goes beyond the forces and powers and laws of nature and physics and science that we live under. And we said that question mark, that's something which is beyond that, which was there in the beginning, that preceded everything we understand, that something is God. And we left it enigmatic. We didn't go into details, because when you say something is beyond our logical understanding, so then what can he say? We don't know. So what we do know is from the Torah. And we discussed that there are two ways of approaching the basics of Jewish belief. We said one is that way, working backwards. And the other one is recognizing the revelation that that was at Sinai, and when the Jews left Egypt, and when God reveals himself and says, hey, I am like this and I am like that, so then you have a picture of what God is. And we said that really the Kuzari stresses that approach, the approach of we might not know anything, and our first encounter with God is the fact that he reveals himself at our Exodus, our leaving of Egypt, and at Sinai. And from there we work our way back, like we say in Kiddush. God is the one who took us out of Egypt, and from there we know that he's also the one who created the world. But it begins with his revelation. At the same time, we have to recognize that there's going to have to be another approach, another way of connecting with God, because our patriarch, Avraham Avinu, Abraham, he recognized God before the Torah was given, before leaving Egypt, and he had faith for many, many years before God revealed himself. According to some opinions, 70 years. He held this belief that God created the world, there's one God, and there's no point in serving idols, etc. And the God who created the world is there, and he's watching over us, and God didn't speak to him. So that's 72 years, according to one understanding, that he's living with this faith, and how much does he see of it? So we also have the Midrash that he was saved when he was thrown into the fire, but he was willing to be thrown into the fire before he saw any miracles, just based upon that faith. So that means there is going to have to be another way of coming to that conclusion.
Yeah, but God probably saw that he can last 72 years. Maybe if God saw that he would have lasted only 40 years, he would have probably been able to fall sooner.
Maybe. All I'm saying is that we have to recognize that there's the Kuzari's approach, and there is going to have to be another approach. And we represented one angle of that other approach. Now, the Rambam over here is stressing that God is eternal, but eternal not only in to the future, but God is also has also eternally been here. He precedes everything. Now, notice that the Rambam has not yet said that God is eternal going backwards, that He always was. God, the Rambam has said that the world is here because of God, and if He wouldn't be here, then the world wouldn't be here. And He has also said that God precedes everything. You with me? But the Rambam did not say the point that I just said, that God's precedence is eternal. That God not only precedes everything, but He always was here. Now that we could infer by default, but that's where we start entering the realm, I think, of what our sages said. If you try to figure that one out, you could lose it. Give me just a second.
So the Kuzari goes as far as saying we know God until only when he came and at Sinai, and we know Him as the one who liberated us from slavery.
Yeah, but the Kuzari is stressing that our faith begins with that. When God introduces Himself at Sinai, He says, "I am the God who took you out of Egypt." Right. He doesn't say, "I am the God who created the world."
Right.
Because the place where God connected to the Jewish people is by taking us out of Egypt. And by virtue of that, we
are witnessing with our own eyes. We can basically say He's the one who took us out of Egypt. The God who took us out of Egypt. We weren't there in creation, so we don't know, right? So Rambam goes further, you're saying.
The Rambam in general, in his Guide for the Perplexed and Mor Nebuchim, takes on a different approach. But I don't think that they are mutually exclusive. They're both okay. I'm saying they don't need my approval. Who am I? But they're two different approaches. So I'm saying over here, the Rambam is discussing God's being eternally preceding to the world. And let's continue for a second. V'arayot lezeh v'sfarim arbeh. And the proofs to this point are in many, many books. V'zeh ha'yisod ha'rvi'i. And this fourth foundation, tenet of Jewish faith, hu shemoreh alav ma shenemar, that this foundation, what's pointing to it in the Torah, is the verse that states, me'ona elokei kedem. This is one of the last verses in the Torah. This is at the very end in Mezos HaBracha. And the Rambam understands it, that the Pasuk is coming to say that God's presence, God was here preceding everything that's in the world.
How do we translate that verse? Simple translation.
I think the Rambam's understanding is that me'ona is the term is like ma'on, a place of being. Elokei kedem, the place of being of God is kedem, always preceding, like preceding everything.
Which verse?
That is what? Where is that? That's in Vezot HaBracha Dvarim. Says down here, chapter 33, verse 27. Speak to everyone else. I am.
Shut down.
Vida, and you should know, ki ha'yisod ha'gadol shel Torat Moshe Rabbeinu, that the great foundation of Moshe, our teacher's Torah, hu heyot ha'olam mechudash, is that the world is a new creation. Meaning the philosophers claim, the way you see the world, that's the way it's always been. What do you mean, that's the way it's always been? Well, that's the way it's always been. So, if you remember, we discussed in the introduction to our first class, the introduction to the Rambam's introduction, we discussed that the first step, logically, is to say what the philosopher said. You come to me and say, there's a God? I don't know about a God. What I know about is this world, and that man comes from man. You have a question, man comes from man, how does that work, where did it begin? I don't know. But the only thing I do know is that man has always been coming from man. If you show me man come from something else, I'll admit that man comes from something else, but I don't see it. You want to show me something being created in the world? Fine, I'll believe it when I see it. But if I don't see it, so in the realm of my knowledge and my understanding, this is the world, this is the way it is, then this must be the way it always was. Oh, you have a question, where did it begin? So you have a question. That question doesn't lead to God. So we said that question is God. But that's how we answered that. But the step before that is the step that the philosophers took. They said, what you see is what always was. You want to say something else was, so you have to prove it. If you can't prove it, so I have to assume that this is what always was. I have a question, what was before that? So I have a question. That question doesn't, a question isn't an answer. A question is a question. So we said, no. Like, being that that question is a logical question, and logic dictates that there was a beginning, so we said that question is God. Because we said, otherwise you'll ask, okay, so what was before God? You're always going to ask what came first. So we said, yeah, that question of what came first, that there's something that's beyond our scope of understanding, that's God. We said, that's the first step in defining or recognizing God, that there is something beyond our understanding. But the Rambam over here is saying that one of the foundations of the Torah is the fact that the world is a new creation. This is a new world. It's not a world that always was. There was creation, and according to this, we understand maybe a different understanding as to why the Torah begins from Bereshis. Rashi asks, why does the Torah start from Bereshis? So Rashi says, the purpose of the Torah is to teach us mitzvot. So tell me the commandments. Why do you have to tell me everything that preceded it? The Rambam doesn't necessarily agree with Rashi's understanding as to why we have the Torah. It could be the Rambam understands that the Torah is teaching us not only the mitzvot, but also a way of living philosophically. And then the Rambam saying the basis, the beginning of philosophy is in Judaism that the world was creation, that there was creation. And then according to the Rambam, it's very fundamental that the Torah begins with creation. It's not telling us history, the world was created. It's telling us a basis in Jewish faith, which will then allow us to continue the rest of Jewish faith. So
there was a creator in order.
So a creator, you could say, the second you know, there's Hashem, Elohim, there are psukim in the Torah that point to God's being the creator. But the fact that there was creation together with the creator, so according to the Rambam, we have possibly a different understanding as to why the Torah begins with creation, and also a different understanding as to what is the purpose of the Torah. Maybe the Rambam is adding that the Torah is also teaching us the basis of philosophy, which Rashi would also agree to an extent. But we see that Rashi didn't feel like that was enough of a reason to begin with Bereshis. Rashi had to give a different reason. Why does the Torah begin with creation? So the Rambam is saying that this great foundation of the Torah is the fact that the world is a new creation. Yitzaro Hashem, God fashioned it, and God created it after there was complete lacking. There was a complete vacuum. Nothing here. The world was a vacuum. So, we can't understand what that means. And this that you see that I circumvent, I get around the belief that the world is eternal, that the world always was, which is the philosopher's view, and this is so that we'll have a clear sign that God exists as I explained in the Moreh Nevuchim. And because of that, I brought today Moreh Nevuchim. I have here a few copies, the Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed, and we'll see a little bit of it. See how much time allows. Maimonides writes in his introduction to the Guide to the Perplexed, to the Moreh Nevuchim, that he wrote this book for a student. The student sent him letters asking him questions, and he told him, I see you have very, very good questions, and you've come up with the right questions, and the right things are bothering you, and therefore I decided I'm going to write this compilation to explain it to you. But he says this compilation is for people who have learned the whole Torah. They know everything. They've learned all science, all philosophy. When you've finished everything there is to know about Torah and nature and science, then you should learn this book. But, says the Rambam, I know people aren't going to listen to me, and they're going to read this book even though they're not ready for it. So I can't reveal all the secrets openly. So I'm going to hide some of the secrets, and you're going to have to figure out how to put the things together. I'll give you the keys. I'll open it up. And you'll have to put stuff together. I'm not going to answer it all in one place. I'll hint to things and allude to things, and I'll answer it in different places where if you put it all together, you'll get the right answers. But I'm not going to write it openly, the Rambam says, because I know people won't listen to me and they'll end up reading it, even though they're not ready. Now, the Mor Nevuchim is divided into a few sections, and it was originally written in Arabic, and it was translated. We have here Rav Kapach's translation. So it's the second part of the book.
The Rambam speaks Hebrew.
The Rambam spoke Hebrew, but he wrote this book in Arabic.
Why he chose that?
I don't know why.
Was it in Morocco?
Mor Nevuchim, the guide to the perplexed. So it's page Kuf Tzadivav, 196.
He wrote
it
in Morocco?
You want to give me yours?
He wrote it in Morocco?
I don't know historically where he was when he wrote it. Kuf Tzadivav. I'm not sure you'll get that much out of the English version. For example, the Rambam in the beginning has a dictionary. He defines a lot of terms. And to start reading it in the English version, to understand what it means, I'm not sure you'd get that much out of it, but you could try. It's reading a translated dictionary, you understand? It's a deeper dictionary, but the concept, you have to have a hold on the language a little bit. What?
Translation.
Yeah, if you have a good translation, then maybe you could follow.
But again, it was translated already from Arabic, so
right.
Already was the translation already there.
But the terms he's defining are Hebrew terms.
Oh, yeah.
You pegged at Vav, we're holding the 15th chapter. Matarati v'perek zeh. My point in this chapter, Leva'er, to explain ki Aristo, that Aristotle, en lo chachal kadmuto olam kefi hashkafato, that Aristotle does not have a proof that the world is eternal, has always been here, as he thinks, as he philosophizes. Ve'eino toe bekach. And he's not mistaken when he thinks that he's proven it. Klomar, shehu atzmo yodea she'en lo chachal kach. Aristotle himself knows that he doesn't have a proof that the world is eternal, that it's always been there. Veshotan ha'ochachot v'arayot shehu omer otan, and that those proofs that Aristotle brings, hem asher nir'in v'noteh adat aleihen yoter, they seem to be right, and one would be inclined to follow them. V'asfekot behem hachi me'atot kefi shemedame Alexander. And there are very few places, there's very little room to doubt what Aristotle is saying. But don't think that Aristotle himself thinks that he's proven that the world is eternal and has always been here. For Aristotle is the one that taught mankind how to prove things and the laws of logic and the conditions of logic. And therefore he himself knows that that his proofs aren't whole, that there are holes in his proof, even though it seems like he's got good proofs, but he himself knows that he hasn't really proven that the world always was. The reason I have to point this out, the Rambam says, is because the latter students of Aristotle think that Aristotle has proven that the world always was. Therefore, many of the philosophers rely on Aristotle in this point. And they think whatever Aristotle said must be well proven. There's no room to doubt. And they find it difficult to argue on Aristotle. Or to say that maybe he missed something. Or to say maybe he was mistaken in something. Therefore, I want to guide them together with their philosophies and clarified to them that Aristotle himself did not really claim to prove the answer to this question. So, what's the Rambam out to prove? That even Aristotle didn't think that the world was eternal and has always been here. I'm wondering if it pays to go into the Rambam's proof. I don't think we're gonna continue here. So let's skip to the 16th to the 17th chapter. The Rambam goes into a whole proof working with their philosophies. The next chapter, next page. The 16th chapter, I'm sorry. In this chapter, the Rambam says, I'll explain to you what I think regarding this question. Then I'm going to prove it. He says, there is a group of philosophers who prove that the world was eternal, but I don't think they have good proofs. And I won't say that those who try to mislead people have good proofs, even though they're reaching the same conclusion. And this is an important point. People sometimes think, if you get people to believe what's right, that's fine. What do you care if the way you got there is false? We had about 8 years ago, there was a story of a woman who said that a demon got into her. And a demon, a deep book. And then they brought a bunch of rabbis to her house and the media was there covering it. And they did a whole Kabbalistic thing and they took out the demon from within her. And she had a funny voice talking from her throat. And that funny voice told her, your son has drugs in the basement. And they ran to the basement and they checked under a certain tile. They found drugs and all kinds of things, he said. And then they did this whole Kabbalistic procession. And the demon went out, and suddenly she had a normal voice, and she was healed. And this was all on the media, and these people who wore hats and jackets and called themselves rabbis got millions of dollars in donations. A lot of people believed, wow, they must be great Kabbalistic rabbis, and they did this. And at the time, they started selling the videotape of how this demon was in her and got out of her. And a lot of people did tshuva when they saw that. A lot of people, they saw that, and they did an about face, they changed their way of life. They said, you see, the rabbis know what they're doing, and you see how holy they are, and it's a pity we haven't listened to them until now. And at the same time, someone asked me what I think. So I told them, I think they're a bunch of liars. So he said, So he said, they're rabbis, they're big rabbis. He said, they're not rabbis. They're dressed like rabbis. They're known as rabbis. They're not rabbis. There's a story in New York. Once a group of yeshiva guys were caught doing illegal acts. So the media asked Rabbi Feinstein, they said, how do you answer up to the yeshiva community when such a group of yeshiva boys, fine religious Orthodox students, go ahead and break the law in such a terrible fashion? So he said, I'll give you an example, and you from the example can hear the answer. If a group of people walk into a costume store and rent out costumes, policeman costumes, and then they take those costumes and dressed as policemen, they walk into a store or into a bank and they pull out guns and they hold up the bank and they steal the money, are you afterwards going to go and ask the commissioner and say, how do you answer up to the policemen behaving this way? How do you justify the fact that policemen are behaving like this? You're not going to say that. You can say it's ridiculous. They're not policemen. They just put on costumes of policemen, right? Same thing here. So what? So they're dressed like yeshiva boys. These aren't yeshiva boys. People who go and behave in this fashion. So they wore the costume. That doesn't make them yeshiva boys. I don't have to answer that. So that's what Rabbi Feinstein answered then. So I quoted that then. I said, these people, they might be wearing hats, they might be wearing jackets, they might have long beards, and they might put the title rabbi before their name, but they're not rabbis. I'm sorry. It's not everything they did. And this was, so people branded me an apikarius. They said, you're a heretic. I'm not talking to you. And I said, look, I'm sorry, I don't see any halachic foundation for rabbis bringing video cameras to videotape a woman. I never saw it, but I was told what was there. And the fashion that she was there, it's not tsanua. If there are such holy rabbis, how do you show a woman lying down? And everything that was done there, I don't see it as being tsanua. And if they're so holy, then the last thing they would agree to is to do this in front of a video camera. So the fact that they were willing to do it in front of a TV camera, to me, means they're not holy. And it's impossible that they did this. This isn't, said, everything else we could discuss a different time. But just to begin with that, once they did that, there's nothing to talk about. They're not, this is a hoax. So I was branded a heretic. And 6 months later, the woman came to the media and she told them, look, it was all a fake. Here, I'll reenact it for you. I can make the same voice. They promised me a cut in the money and they never gave it to me. So now I'm telling you the truth. It was all a fake. And then she lied down and she made the same voice come from her throat. And she did the whole thing all over again. And it became public knowledge that it was a fake. Some people still haven't heard this end of the story. But that's what happened a few months later. It took about a half a year till it happened. Why is this relevant? Because at the time, people said, what do you care if it's true or not? It's causing people to do tshuva. I told them, tshuva that's based on a lie isn't good. We see in all the Rishonim, and here we see it again, that we don't only look at the conclusion and say, if you could bring him to keep Torah and mitzvahs, what do you care if you liked it? No, do it right. Go and teach people the truth. But don't say, I'll make a lie, I'll put on a show, I'll do something fake, and what do I care? At the end of the day, they're doing what's right. We don't base our religion on lies. We don't say, so long as he does it. Teach him, he should do it. But teach him the truth. Don't work that way. There are some people that you have to work on certain angles of the truth. We once had a couple that came and they didn't want to keep, the wife didn't want to keep certain laws. So they were already married. And what are you going to tell her? Yeah.
Are we allowed to find out who those rabbis were? I wouldn't
want to
listen to those rabbis.
Okay, I don't think there's much of a chance you'd get to them. They still have Hasidim surrounding them who won't let you get close.
I mean, there's things on the internet, though, like from all these rabbis, all these different things. And, like, you read what they said. I don't know, I guess.
Some of them are good. Before Pesach, I had to do some research. There were new products out. People asked me. I went on the internet. I was very impressed. You could go to our reliable sites. There's the CRC, there's the OU. There are reliable sites where you could go and ask your questions and get answers.
But I guess what they said, I'm not talking about like soccer or anything. Obviously, I wouldn't go to those rabbis. But I mean, I was just saying, like, in general, like, if there's like, you know, there's like an online debate, I guess you could still listen to them and like learn from them, no?
If it's these people, I wouldn't. No. No, sorry. The Gemara says that when you come to learn Torah, so the Pasuk describes the Rebbe is Kimalach Hashem Tzvakot Hu, is the Malach of Hashem. And the Gemara says we derive from that if you find the person who's teaching you to be, as a human being, a fine person, learn from him. And if you don't learn from him. If he's im dome beinecha kemalach, the Gemara says, if you look at him and you see an angel, you see that he's a good person, then you could learn from him. Otherwise, no. That's one of the first criteria. When I look who to ask questions to, I look to see who the person is.
Where it is?
I think. I think it's a Gemara in Chulin. I want to look it up. I have to get back to it. I think it's in Chulin, but I'm not sure. But it's a Gemara. It's a Gemara which is also quoted, if I'm not mistaken, in the Rambam. So sometimes like a guy quoted to me something that a certain rabbi said, and he was very upset that he said it. So I told him, look, maybe you misunderstood him. I could give you 10 reasons why what he said is perfectly legitimate, even though it sounds like he was just bragging or something else. Maybe you didn't understand him. Maybe he didn't understand how you understood him. A person shouldn't be quick to reach conclusions on these points. But at the end of the day, if this is what's going on, I wouldn't. I would go somewhere else.
No, I understand your hat. Was there any famous rabbis there that we maybe
I don't know. They weren't famous by me, but I don't go looking for Kabbalistic rabbis. So it could be that the world who does go looking for them, by them they were famous. I don't know. I don't know. But the Rambam over here is saying, he's saying even though these philosophers reached the right conclusion, their method of getting there was incorrect, and therefore I'm not going to rely on them. I don't want to cause myself to go in a mistaken fashion and say they proved it when I know that there are flaws in their proofs. It's not so. They reached the right conclusion, but they didn't get there the right way. So the Rambam over here is coming to present the correct proofs that the world always was, that the world that God always was, that God preceded everything, and that the world is not eternal in the past sense, that it wasn't always here. That God did create the world and God always was here.
Here we can see that we can raise a question for everything if we just go in this way. I mean, like, if somebody asks that, how do you know that she is really your mother?
Right.
So how can I know?
It's a good question. I mean, you don't know.
No, I mean, like, we couldn't approach this way because we always see our connection and our experience with the Hashem, like I myself feel that the things that I have, I mean, experiences before, like I saw even some things miracle in life, this and that, but I can't say that I feel the closeness or connected, I mean, but after we leave, the source for everything, that he created everything. Like my mother, she already born me, so we have a mind that can see everything openly. But with question if like this, how can you know this? How can you know that? Do you know this bread comes from really a wheat? It's not a, if it does, it's a, because it says it has the exact flavor of a bread, a wheat, and not a wheat. So these questions are really, do we have to analyze it more?
I think that there are many ways to reaching the right conclusion, and many of them are legitimate. Not everyone has to approach it with the Rambam's fashion of trying to work out the logic, all the logical angles. But if a person is going to approach it logically, then a person has to define for himself logically why it's so. And the truth is that a person does not know who his mother is. There's no way a person could know who his mother is. At best, a person could know what people say his mother is, and a person can say, well, in order to live in this world, I have to take on certain things, assuming that what people say is so. We're going into a whole new philosophical concept of how much things have to be proven. We could begin by saying we don't know anything. What we know is what we perceive. So then, that's the whole question of a priori, yeah?
There are sometimes a case that one can more likely resemble to his uncle than his father.
That's not
so it's not a proof that.
That's not the proof.
Like.
No, that's not the proof.
Yeah.
I'm not saying because he looks like. The
so
Gemara asks.
Any rational approach sometimes it doesn't. Most of the time it's because it doesn't work.
A few things. First of all, questions are legitimate. And the fact that we don't have an answer doesn't take away the legitimacy of a question. So you'll say, how do I know that's my mother? If a person goes and marries his mother, then he's going to get killed and his children are going to be mamzerim. How could you do that? You don't know it's his mother. Who knows it's his mother? No one knows. If a person hits his father, causes him to bleed, he deserves to be killed. How do you know that's his father? That you definitely don't know. The mother, you could still say there were midwives there, they saw him growing up, he had a birthmark, whatever it was. But the father, you for sure can't know, right? How could you know? The Gemara asks, along different lines, the Gemara says, how can you ever kill a person? Let's say a person stabbed someone else. We have witnesses that he took a sword and stabbed someone else. So maybe there was a hole where that went in. Did you check under the clothing? Did the witnesses ever check that there wasn't a hole there? The Torah says that a kohen walks into the house and he sees the white spot on the walls. He sees if it's a certain size. Then when he walks out of the house, if it's still that size, then he says that house is impure. It has tzaras. I'm skipping a lot of details. So the Gemara says, how does he know from the time he left that spot till the time he gets outside the door, maybe the spot shrunk. By the time he wants to say it's impure, maybe it's smaller. So the Gemara deduces that there's a halachic concept called chazaka. That we say there's an assumption that certain things are so, either by virtue of the fact that they have been so until now. If I know that you were alive before I walked out of the room, I could assume you're alive a second after I walk out of the room. Does that mean you are for sure alive? No. But that's a halachic concept, that we can assume certain things are so. But that halachic concept is relevant to halacha. If I'm going to prove something, which is the basis for all of halacha, I can't take a halachic concept that comes from halacha. From that Gemara, we see that the Gemara didn't take it for granted that I could assume when I walk out of the room, you're still alive. I don't know you're alive. I see you here alive now. If I walk out a second later, I don't know if you're alive. Now, halachically, I will assume you're alive. But that's a chidush. The Gemara has to derive that. Meaning the Gemara recognized that logically it doesn't have to be so. It's not 100% foolproof. Now, when we're going to discuss the foundation of all Jewish belief, then you could say, well, it won't be 100%. We'll assume it'll be berech. It seems to make sense. It fits.
More than that, we have an inner thing that said that today I heard one very good example, and maybe to mention it, he was teaching about him, and he said that a bird, there are special birds that flows from South America to California seasonally, and they go back. So he said, they don't have intellect, they don't have memory. So they go from this tree, from this garden tree, so they fly, after 6 months, they come back to exactly the same place. So that, how can that happen? They don't have memory, they don't have intellect, or a compass, or navigation instruments. They have no. But he said that they have a built-in thing that will help them to come back to their origin, not to the other thing, but so every Jew, he said, in order to make a shuva, he has that little faith that can bring him to his contact point. But he should work on it, he said. And we couldn't give him a new thing that will. So what I want to mean is that so far we have the inner sound. I mean, more than the logic convinces us, we have that.
Granted, I'm just saying that that's what we begin with, that the concept that you don't have to reach it with logic. But if you're going to reach it with logic, that logic has to be pure.
It also creates another question. He gives a good conclusion. Even with the wrong way to get a good conclusion.
Because they were trying to prove it. They're trying to prove it. If they'd say we're not proving it, but we're connected from a different point, I don't think the Rambam would have an issue with it. But when they're coming on the stage and saying we will prove it logically, and then their proofs are not logical, then the Rambam has an issue with them. He says, I will not quote them because their proofs aren't logical. I'm saying, we began this class way back when. We said a few things. We said, we're not going to prove the points. We're here to learn what are the basis of Jewish faith. What are the basic beliefs of Jewish faith? We said, we're not going to prove them. We're not going to prove them to be true. That's not what we're spending our class doing. We began the class because there was someone who had to be tested on the 13 principles, and he had to know them. So he said, we're going to study to know the 13 principles. That was why we began the class, not to prove it, and we're not going to prove it. We're bringing the Rambam to understand what the Rambam said over here in his explanation of this fourth foundation. And he said, I explained why I want to circumvent the philosopher's beliefs, and I I am stressing that the world has always been here, so we saw in the Rambam that the Rambam said that even Aristotle didn't believe it. Aristotle presented certain proofs, but Aristotle himself knew there were flaws in his proofs. Aristotle's students, because they saw that Aristotle had presented some proofs to the effect that the world was ever present, they took that to be a truth, a truism, and they adopted it and assumed that Aristotle himself believed it. The Rambam claims that Aristotle did not believe it himself and knew there were flaws in that faith. The Rambam then goes on to expound on what are the flaws in that. And then the Rambam says, I will prove that the world was not ever present and God was ever present, and I'm going to use proofs of my own and not the proofs that were brought by others, because those proofs, even though they lead to the right conclusion, are not true proofs. And we just mentioned in passing that the Rambam is teaching us that the point when you're trying to prove something is not only to get to the right answer, but you need to have the right proofs. Now, you could say maybe the Rambam wouldn't care to go this way if not for the fact that he's writing a book and he knows he has to build things like building blocks one on top of the other. Maybe if it weren't for the fact that it was being published, the Rambam would say, like you're saying, I don't care how you got there, as long as you got to the right place. Could be. I don't think so, but you could argue that point. Yeah? You want to ask something?
If you find yourself suspecting a rabbi's actions, you know that there definitely is a way to interpret the rabbi's actions, but for some reason you keep on clinging to your negative interpretation. What would be the best approach to take? To confront the rabbi and to say, I can't help but interpret your actions negatively. Could you explain to me why you acted that way so that I can learn from you? Would that be a respectful approach?
So this is a... Let's save this. I thought we'd do one more of the Rambam's foundations, but we're out of time. I want to have 10-15 minutes now to discuss how one finds and chooses a rabbi, and we'll try to deal with that. I hope we'll have time for that. I don't think we'll have time for that, no. So in a nutshell, I'll just try to address that. Another point we'll have to do next week. If one sees a rabbi doing something that he could interpret two ways, so we have a tradition that if you see a person who is a positive person, who keeps Torah and mitzvahs generally, do something which can be interpreted in one of two ways, you should judge him favorably. If it keeps nagging you that you don't think that's true, so then ideally one should try and speak to the rabbi in a respectful fashion and ask him. The fact is that sometimes that won't work. You have to catch him when he's not pressed and not in front of other people. And when he's coming, he can answer you. And sometimes he won't be able to answer you on the spot. The Gemara says that if you see a Talmid Chacham sinning by day, don't think about it at night, because by the time the night time came, he did tshuva. So the Gemara doesn't say it's impossible that he messed up. Could be messed up. Everyone messes up. But by night, he did tshuva. It's not that the Gemara is saying, no, for sure, he didn't go wrong. The Gemara does say if you can interpret it two ways, then give him the benefit of the doubt, because he's a person that should be given the benefit of the doubt. But the Gemara then says, and if you see him doing something wrong, so assume he fixed it by night. And then the Gemara adds, that's only in things relating to God. But let's say he owes someone money and he's not paying, so then you don't have to assume anything. He didn't pay. There's nothing to assume. You see him, doing something else that's between him and God. So between him and God, he probably fixed it by night. But between him and man, if he didn't pay, he didn't pay. The Gemara also says that that it's rare, even among the rabbis of the Talmud, to have a rabbi who you could look at his actions and learn from them. The Gemara says that's a very special level. Person could be a great rabbi and still not be on the level that when you see him do something, you could derive from that it's permissible to do. And the later contemporaries have already said a few hundred years ago that we don't have anyone among us that's on the level that whatever you see him do, you could do. You have to ask him. Even though you see him doing something, you see him eating at a certain restaurant, you see him doing things, the later sages said, there's no longer a person among us who's on the level that whatever you see him do, you could do. You have to be on a certain level not to do things that could be misinterpreted and to always think out what are people seeing and thinking. We're not on that level. Already many, many years ago they said that. Hundreds of years ago. So today you see someone doing something, A, you can't learn from it. You have to ask him, can I infer from this that I could do the following? I was once in the airport. I thought, no one knows me here. Someone had asked me to get a certain bubble gum for them. It wasn't a great hechsher, but it had a hechsher. So I said, okay, this is what they asked for. It has a hechsher. I'm not going to second guess them. There's a Haredi family standing next to me. The kid asks his mother, I want that bubble gum. So she says, okay, I see the rabbi's getting it. You could have it too. So I said, wait, I'm not going to eat it. It's not for me. I said, look, it has a kosher symbol, but it's not the greatest hechsher. I don't know if I would recommend eating it. And then I thought to myself, you see, that's what they said. You see someone doing something. It's nothing you could do. I don't know. They saw me with the heavy jacket. They figured, okay, if he's doing it, it's okay. So today we don't have anyone on that level. I think so. I think that's what it says. You can't look at any rabbi and say, because he's doing something, it's okay. You could ask him if you did it. And of course, ask him in a way that you won't offend him, not in front of other people, and at a time when he could sit down and think and answer you. And he might surprise you and say, you didn't see correctly, or there were different circumstances. Ask him. Or he might say, you misunderstood me. Or he might even say, you know what? I made a mistake. That happens too. So, and we'll continue next week.